Welcome to the Cops and Writers Podcast. On this show, you will learn how to write the best crime-related novel or screenplay possible. Your host, Sergeant Patrick O'Donnell, worked the streets in one of the nation's largest police departments for over 25 years. Ride along with O'Donnell and his expert guests as they help you navigate the oftentimes confusing and misunderstood world of law enforcement. O'Donnell and his guests on this show do not represent any law enforcement agency. The content of this show is not meant to be legal advice. If you think you need a lawyer, you probably do.
Hey, Cops and Writers, thanks for being here with us today for episode number 10 of the Cops and Writers Podcast. I'm Patrick O'Donnell, and I will be your host for today's show. Our guest for today's show is Jennifer Severino. Jennifer has over 20 years of experience with the criminal courts, first as a paralegal, and then a decade as a criminal defense attorney. She is also a successful author of 35 published books and a freelance editor at her company, Twitching Pen Editing, where she provides services as a content and line editor, beta reader, book description writer, and legal fiction consultant. Jennifer tells us about her interest in the law at an early age that never left her. She also gives us a view of the criminal justice system from the perspective of being a defense attorney. Jennifer and I discuss different cases, most notably serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer and the defense that was given during the trial. Jennifer Severino also discusses her successful writing, business, and marketing strategies with us. All of this and more on today's episode of the Cops and Writers Podcast. Jennifer Severino, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right. I think I'm going to start out with something that you told me in passing a while ago. Just full disclosure, Jennifer and I have been friends for a while, and she's also my editor for the last two Cops and Writers books. So we've had lots of chats, and we're both from Wisconsin. Well, I'm from Chicago, but I'm in Wisconsin now. And something you said that stuck in my head that I never asked you about was you were voted most likely to get held in contempt when you were in law school. Tell me a little bit about that.
I was. So your third year of law school, kind of a mess. And as a, you know, kind of fun thing to do at the end of the year, the class always votes for certain awards. And one of them is who's most likely to be held in contempt of court. And I was unanimously voted most likely to be held in contempt of court because, and I mean, our class had 300 people in it or something.
Okay.
So, it wasn't a huge number of people, but I kind of had a reputation for arguing with professors if I didn't agree with what they were saying, you know, their logic or something. And I loved playing devil's advocate. My husband, who I was in law school with, was the same way. We would both play devil's advocate in class, but I'm by far the more outspoken of the two of us. So I'm the one who got that reputation. They also called me Gunner all the time in class because I was always like shooting at people like, nope, you're wrong. Like,
how did you know what? I mean, you always think of law school as this kind of stoic environment where, you know, it's pretty much all business. And some of those professors, you know, obviously the stereotype on TV is, you know, they're like 500 years old. They look like fossils up there. And, you know, they kind of, how did they take that? Or am I totally wrong?
Well, it depends on the professor for sure.
Sure.
There were a lot of professors. I would say most of our professors were probably like in their late 40s or early 50s. So They weren't like the super ancient ones that you picture in like movies and TV that are, you know, 90-year-old legal scholars. We had a couple who were like older, but most of them were pretty young. And most of them had really good attitudes, and they encouraged and fostered discussion and argument. And, you know, it's part of being a lawyer is having to make your own argument and having to look at something from a different perspective and say, that's not how I see it, and arguing about it.
Sure.
So most of them were really good about it. There were three or four professors who had reputations that you were like, you don't want to speak up in that class. You don't want to argue with the professor. You don't, it will affect your grade. Like, don't.
Okay.
And so there were ones that you definitely couldn't do it or you shouldn't do it.
But shouldn't do it. Yes.
Didn't mean I didn't, but you know, my grade was at risk every time.
Yeah. I was always wondering about that. And that sounds kind of funny. So where did all this begin? how did your interest in the law start? When did you know that you wanted to be an attorney?
Pretty much from a very early age. I think I was maybe 10 or 11, 12, something like that. And I used to watch Matlock all the time. And it's such a bad example because it's so illegally inaccurate. But I just loved Matlock. I loved what he did in the courtroom. And I got involved in Green Bay, where I grew up. They had a youth court.
Okay.
And it was literally a court. It was a legal court. And what these people would do if you were under a certain age, and God, this was, I'm aging myself here, but this was 25 years ago. If you were under a certain age, I think it might've been 16, the judge in your case could waive you out of circuit court into teen court, into youth court. And you would go and you would be in front of a jury of other teen members, and there would be a teen judge, and you get to argue the facts of your case, and the jury would essentially give you what your punishment was. And it was always community service or something community based.
Okay.
But it was kind of an alternative for people who may have ended up in the juvie system. You know, who may have ended up under some sort of juvenile supervision. Sure. So I don't know if this still exists in Green Bay, because like I said, this was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But I got involved in that at a really young age. I want to say I was like 12 or 13 when I got involved in that.
So were you an attorney in that? Were you an attorney?
They didn't really have attorneys. Like you had a representative or whatever, but no, but I did mock trial in high school and I loved mock trial. And growing up, it was kind of one of those things people always said to me, you need to be a lawyer when you grow up. And it was kind of, you know, said in jest because I love to argue. And they were like, yeah, you really should be a lawyer when you grow up. And I just loved it so much that I eventually was like, yeah, I really should.
Okay. So what was your major when you were an undergrad?
So I double majored in undergrad in writing intensive English and political science with the intent to go to law school. I've always excelled at English and writing. So that was kind of a no-brainer.
Okay.
And obviously the political science side was super helpful with planning to go to law school.
Sure.
The other thing is I always knew I wanted to do criminal defense.
Oh, okay.
I never wanted to do any other area of law. I wanted to be in a courtroom defending people. Like that was I only went to law school to become a criminal defense attorney.
So I'm going to date myself and talk about Perry Mason, because he was like the ultimate defense attorney. You know, he was always kicking that DA's ass, you know, every time. You felt bad for him.
Very unrealistic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I was always wondering that ADA, how does he have a job? Because he loses every week, you know,
every week.
He just, oh, my God.
He would have been demoted to traffic court a long time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You keep on messing up those murder cases. Yeah. Maybe this isn't the right path for you. All right. So anybody in your family, like mom, dad, anything like that, were they attorneys?
No, we don't have any lawyers in my family at all, actually. Not even extended family. I'm the only one.
So your mom, dad, they must be pretty proud, I would imagine.
We'll be right back.
Today's episode is sponsored by the thrilling audiobook Avenging Adam, book one in the FBI Canine Thriller series written by author Jody Burnett. Sparks fly between hotshot FBI agent Rick Sanchez and no-nonsense FBI canine handler Kendra Dean as they chase a ruthless serial killer. Witness an electrifying blend of suspense, romance, and redemption, where internal conflicts challenge our heroes as much as their target does. Will they catch the killer before it's too late? Grab Avenging Adam now. It's more than a story. It's an experience. Get 50% off the Avenging Adam audiobook at jody-burnett.com/copsandwriters.
They are. They have, I guess, some moral qualms with me representing criminals or people accused of crimes. I think that they would have much preferred if I had been a district attorney or if I had gone into a non-criminal and, you know, done insurance defense or something like that. They have a hard time wrapping their head around me representing certain types of people. And I've had to like have conversations with them where I say, you know, this is not about trying to get someone off. You know, this is about making sure that the process is followed properly, that the police do their job properly, that the district attorney does their job properly, that the court does their job properly, that everybody has a fair shake. And 99% of cases don't go to trial. 99% right. of the time, you're not saying I'm not guilty. You're saying I'm guilty and my attorney's going to try to get me a slightly better deal.
Sure.
That's essentially what 99% of a job of a criminal defense attorney is you review the case file, you see if there's any basis to file a motion that might get the case dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
You challenge that, you know, maybe the police did an illegal stop or an illegal seizure or an illegal search or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you see if you can get it tossed out of a plea resolution. That's 99% of cases. You know, I know people who have been out of law school for 10 years and have never done a jury trial.
Wow.
And it's not because, they're not good attorneys. It's
right.
just because the nature of the system is that the vast majority of people don't come to you and say, I didn't do this. That's just not
right.
That's not most of them. Does it happen? Absolutely. I've represented hundreds of people who have come to me and said, look, this isn't true. This isn't what happened. I didn't do this. And those are the ones that end up going to trial potentially.
Sure.
But I will say that even 75% of those cases, you get there the day of trial and the DA says, you're right. I can't prove my case.
Okay.
Or, you know, the victim won't cooperate or
right.
whatever it might be. They can't meet their burden. So the case ends up getting dismissed anyway. And yet again, you don't have another trial.
You know,
so,
yeah, all this opened my eyes when I became a cop. You know, I called it McJustice. You know, the first couple of times you're subpoenaed, you know, I'm working late shift, midnight to 8 a.m. And I'm there with, you know, 20, 30 other cops. And we all have a jury trial set for 8:30 a.m. I'm like, how could that be? Well, you know, then they cleared the calendar and, you know, it's let's make a deal. You know, the defense attorney and the DA are going to talk about it. And I was in shock. I thought, you know, being new, I didn't know any different and I was never arrested before. So I didn't have a lot of, you know, contact with this. So I'm like, oh, is this how it's going to be? Until the first time I testified, I'm like, okay, no, this isn't. You have to be ready to go. And the same thing with you. You got to be ready. And you have to have all your ducks in a row. But as far
as I can't tell you how many times I spent an entire weekend. So we always did jury trials on Tuesdays.
Okay.
In Wisconsin, most of the courts, most of the counties started their jury trials on Tuesdays. And I don't know why that was. It just happened to be that way.
Right.
And so I cannot count the number of times I spent all weekend finalizing the trial prep that I'd been working on for months and going over my openings and, you know, my questioning and making sure I had everything prepared just to walk in there Tuesday morning and have the DA be like, can we resolve this? and I would say, I've been trying to get an offer from you that was decent for the last 6 months. If you had given me a decent offer 6 months ago, we could have had a nice weekend instead.
Yeah.
We both worked, you know,
but you have to do it though.
Yep,
right.
It's the nature of the business.
So when you are getting ready for, like, say your opening statement or your closing statement, I interviewed Sharon Rick and she says hello, by the way.
Yes.
You know, she was the other side of the table. You know, she's a prosecutor. She was a DA. And she was talking about, you know, I asked her, you know, how would you get ready for, you know, your opening statement, your closing statement? Because, you know, on TV, your movies, that's always like the big dramatic, you know, especially the closing. You know, it's like, yes, right. You know, they tried to do this, but I showed you that. You're trying to sell your case to the jury. You know, you're walking exactly. around, you're kind of flinging your arms around and doing whatever it takes to get your point across. How did you do it in front of a mirror? Did you tape it? Did you videotape yourself?
Oh God, no, I didn't do any of that. I'm pretty comfortable talking to people.
Okay.
I don't have a shy bone in my body. So it's not hard for me to stand up in front of a jury and say, look guys, here's the case. Here's what I'm going to show you during my questioning of these witnesses. And here's what I think is you're at the end of the trial. Here's what I think you're going to have been presented with. And I'm going to ask you to come back with a not guilty verdict.
Right.
Openings are a lot easier to plan than closings because you don't know what's going to come out during the trial.
Sure, sure.
I mean, you think you do, but you don't. I mean, okay. I've never had a jury trial where something didn't surprise me. Like, that's just the nature of it. People say things that are totally right. opposite what's in their reports, or people change their story. And even a witness you've prepared and questioned, and they've come into your office and you've sat down with them three times. Even those people might say something you're not expecting. So your opening, you can kind of plan out, this is the story I'm going to tell the jury. A lot of it is they promised you X in their opening, but they never showed that. Right. They promised you Y in their opening. They never showed that. They promised you Z. They never showed that.
So all all you have to do is put a shadow of doubt in these exactly. jurors' minds, because it has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So when you start, planting the doubt monsters in these jurors' heads, that's what you're trying to do.
Right. And in Wisconsin, we have a very good jury instruction for what reasonable doubt is. Every state has their own jury instruction. So every state's might be slightly different.
Okay.
But the jury instruction in Wisconsin for reasonable doubt is something along the lines of, if you can reconcile the facts of this case with any other theory besides guilt, you must find the person not guilty.
Okay.
So any reasonable theory at all is reasonable doubt in Wisconsin.
Right.
So all you have to convince a jury of is that there are other reasonable explanations for what happened. Either somebody's lying, that's a reasonable explanation. You know, somebody misidentified your client, that's a reasonable explanation. All you have to do is convince them it's reasonable, and the jury instruction tells them you must find them not guilty.
Okay. That makes perfect sense. Circling back a little bit, we're talking about your mom and dad, and they're thinking it's like, well, Jennifer is letting all these, evil people off the hook, that kind of thing. Yeah, but when I first started, I thought the same thing. Defense attorneys are bad. They're just looking for any little technicality to let this guy off because he just killed somebody. A child molester or whatever. But then as you get into it more and you get more time and experience under your belt, then my opinion was such that they're also protecting the system.
Exactly.
You're defending the criminal justice system where everybody should have a fair shake, no matter where you're from, no matter what you look like, everybody should have a fair shake. And then I'd have other coppers that were like, defense attorneys suck, this is bullshit, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, someday you might need a defense attorney. You never know. So you may not want to poo-poo it so much, but you're trying to defend, even Jeffrey Dahmer had a fair trial,
I actually used to work for Jerry Boyle, who represented Jeffrey Dahmer. And that was quite the experience.
I bet it was.
Who my professor for criminal law was at Marquette? One of the district attorneys who prosecuted Jeffrey Dahmer.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. It was Father O'Mara.
Okay.
And he had been a district attorney in Milwaukee, and he was the ADA on the case. So he was like the second chair district attorney in the prosecution.
For people who don't know what a second chair is, could you explain that?
So there's typically a lead attorney on both the defense side and the prosecution mm-hmm. side, who is the primary person. They're going to handle the bulk of the case. And then there's a second chair, and the second chair just means kind of like the second step in the pyramid. They might do some of the questioning. They might do none of the questioning, but they sit at the table and assist the head attorney.
Right.
When I was a second chair on various cases, when I was just starting out, before I was capable of handling those big, big cases. Like, I think I second chaired 3 or 4 homicide cases before I ever took one myself, just so that I would have experience in handling homicide cases. And on those, I did some of the questioning. I did the opening on one of the cases, but the lead attorney wanted to do the closing, which I was totally in agreement with because in those type of cases, like that's where experience matters.
Sure.
Yeah. So a second chair is somebody who is kind of the assistant, but that doesn't mean that they're not involved. It doesn't mean they don't talk to the jury. It doesn't mean they don't actively participate in the case necessarily. That's a decision that's made between the attorneys. Right. And so this particular attorney, Father O'Meara, Greg O'Meara, he had been an assistant district attorney, mm-hmm. and the Jeffrey Dahmer case traumatized him essentially so badly that he went to seminary and became a Catholic priest because of what he saw during that case. Yep. He said he had never seen such depravity and so much just horror. And it literally made him find God and become a priest.
It shook him right down to his soul.
It shook him. It literally shook him to his soul. And so he was one of my law school professors. And between undergrad and law school, I had worked for Jerry Boyle, who had represented Jeffrey Dahmer. So it was kind of a funny dynamic because he knew I had worked for Boyle. I knew that he had prosecuted Dahmer. And so we had some conversations about the case.
Yeah, what did he say about it? I mean, like, okay, yeah, my client is Jeffrey Dahmer. He ate people. He was a serial killer. You know, that it doesn't get any more horrific than that.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, that it's such an interesting case if you actually know all the details about it, because, you know, essentially the defense was he's insane. He's criminally insane. He can't be held legally responsible for his actions because he was not in control of them. And look at everything he did. He had to be insane to have done these things. That was their defense. Okay. And had he been found not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, which is what we call it in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. He would have gone, no doubt in my mind, he would have gone for the rest of his life to a mental health facility like Mendota, which is one of the major ones in Wisconsin.
Yep.
So that's what would have happened. However, the jury found that he was legally responsible. The jury ended up finding that he had taken steps that proved he knew what he was doing was wrong, that he even said during some of his interviews that he tried to control himself and he tried to stop himself and he could, you know. So there were definitely moments of lucidity that, you know, where he was making conscious steps to hide bodies. He was making conscious steps to take, you know, he took a couple of the victims to the Ambassador Hotel because he knew it would be harder for them to trace it back to him if he took them to a hotel.
So
things like that.
You could prove premeditation. And like you said, he's planning
and
things. So do crazy people do that? You know, that's what it boils down to.
Right. Well, and I mean, some do. I mean, the I'm not going to get into the intricacies of my defense, but that was essentially their defense. And the state said, no, look at all these other things he did and how he did them. He wasn't insane. He's just a bad person who does bad things.
Okay.
And that's what the jury ended up finding when they agreed with the state. And that's why he ended up going to prison instead of to a mental health facility.
When I was a newer cop, the detective who interrogated Dahmer was, I believe it was a homicide. Yeah, it was a homicide detective. And whenever I'd bring somebody, you know, I'm a newer guy, and I found out through the grapevine, that's the guy that was locked in a room with Jeffrey Dahmer for I don't know how many hours. And they said, he's like, And I would always listen in on his interviews, on his interrogations. And he was so damn good. And I mean, he wasn't confrontational at all.
No, the best ones aren't.
Yeah, this guy was probably about 6'3", 6'4". He was a big dude, but he didn't push it around. Before long, you know, whoever he's questioning or interrogating wants to sit down and have a beer with him. You know, he would literally crawl into their heads, you know, and show some empathy. But I couldn't even imagine doing that for hours with, here's this serial killer cannibal across from the desk from you. And there isn't a whole lot that's between the two of you. You know, picture it's not much bigger than a closet. They're small rooms. And back then,
I find them when my clients are getting interviewed. And I always tell, you know, people ask me, how do you sit across a small table like that or sit at counsel table with somebody who's accused of a violent murder or accused of whatever? And I'll tell you, there's only one time in my entire career, and that's 20 years between being a paralegal and an attorney, mm-hmm. of doing this, of going into prisons and going into jails. only one time was I ever actually afraid for my life, where I honestly thought that the person would hurt me.
Okay.
And that was when he looked me dead in the eye and he said, "I'm sorry for what I'm going to have to do to you."
Oh.
And I kind of looked at him and he had been suicidal. He had already been taken. He had already tried to commit suicide twice in the jail. And they had taken him and he finally was competent and he was back and we were going into court the next day. And I said, "Now, why are you talking like that?"
Yeah.
You know, it makes it seem like you're going to do something bad tomorrow and, you know, in court. And I thought he was going to try to commit suicide by a cop in court and have one of the deputies shoot him. So, and I'm the one sitting right next to him. So I'm going like, yeah, he's going to strangle me or he's going to, you know, stab me with a pen or he's going to do something. So I walked in and I talked to the deputy and I said, "I'm going to sit at the table with him, but I want to sit on the other end of the table. I want him on the side of the table so that we're not actually next to each other, but that he's on the edge so that it makes it harder for him to get across because they are chained." I asked that his hands stay chained because a lot of times, as you know, they don't chain their hands. They only chain their feet.
Right.
And
they have the shock belt on.
And they did not because, It was actually part of his competency hearing that we were going in for. It wasn't like a jury trial or anything.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And so we had this, but I had this, I honestly sat there in court thinking that he was going to do something, you know.
That's distracting.
And he wasn't a bad guy. He was a super, super nice guy when he was mentally stable.
Okay.
He just was not a mentally stable person. And when and I mean, that's part of the other thing with being a criminal defense attorney. I mean, I would say 75% of my clients have mental health issues and they do things that they would never normally do when they are in the grips of some sort of mental issue. And, you know, they're off their meds or their meds stop working or they don't know that they have this issue and they're undiagnosed. And once they're on their medication and they receive their diagnosis, it's a totally different story and they're a totally different person. And I ended up going on to represent him for a long time and I ended up getting his case dismissed in the end. And, but you know, that was the only time I actually was in fear.
Was he accused of something violent or was it like a property crime?
It was a burglary.
Oh,
it was
okay.
An attempted burglary. It wasn't even, you know, it wasn't a violent offense at all.
Okay.
And
gotcha.
It's just that he, you know, he had these mental health issues, but once he was properly medicated, he apologized for what he said. And I had no problem continuing to represent him. But I mean, I always tell people the murderers are probably the nicest clients I've ever had to deal with and the most respectful people I've ever dealt with. It's the drug dealers who tend to not be as respectful.
Well, yeah, I can totally understand that. A lot of time, you know, the homicides are crimes of passion. They are, you know, or they're drunk or high or whatever. And they're arguing over the last beer with their best buddy. I mean, I've had a homicide over a beer. I'd have a homicide over a chicken leg. I've had, you know, the stupidest shit you could think of. It happens, you know, and usually they're impaired somehow, you know, follow, you know, money. They're jealous. They're greedy. They're jealous, you know, and again, sprinkling a bunch of alcohol or other substances. And that's a recipe for disaster. And some people can't handle their shit and they have tempers that are out of control. And that's when bad stuff happens. So, that is a true story. There's no doubt about that. So what's the difference between a defense attorney and a public defender? I know the public defender usually, you know, you don't have to pay for it if you don't have the means. But how does somebody, how does that work?
So a public defender is a defense attorney.
Right.
Okay. But how public defenders work is they're employed by the state. And when you get arrested, you are automatically given a public defender for your initial appearance.
Okay.
That is just standard procedure. And that is unless you've already hired a private attorney.
Okay? Right. And just so people know, that doesn't happen right away. IRS, your public defender isn't going to be there in 5 minutes in the booking room. You know,
No.
It's much later on.
That's for your first appearance in court, which is typically within 48 hours.
Yes.
And so you'll go to court. A lot of people go to court that morning of their initial appearance, mm-hmm. and they haven't talked to an attorney at all. And the public defender will come back and say, okay, tell me who you are. Tell me where you live. Tell me if you have a job. Tell me if you have kids. And they get their basic information so that they can go in and argue bail for them.
Okay.
And they also review the criminal complaint at that initial appearance to see if there's any errors in the criminal complaint that might be able to get the case dismissed right away.
Okay.
That's very rare. The initial appearance is very much a kind of just, this is a simple procedure. We set bail, we get this figured out. So a public defender will do that for everyone, unless you have a private attorney already, which some people do. I mean, I got calls all the time. Hey, my husband was arrested an hour ago. Can you go see him at the jail? And I'd get retained right away.
Okay.
And that happens. But if after your initial appearance, they will assess you to see if you qualify for a public defender.
Okay.
Every state has a level that they set of income that you cannot make more than X number of dollars.
What is it usually? Just for a ballpark.
I'll be honest, I don't even know what it is anymore. I believe it was around $25,000, $30,000 at one point, but
okay.
that may have changed. And it's been such a long time since I've never worked for the public defender's office, so mm-hmm. I don't know what their policy is anymore. But essentially, they assess you. They find out if you qualify. And as long as you make under that amount of money, then they will assign you a public defender to represent you on your case.
Okay.
If you make over that amount of money, you can still ask for one to be appointed to you, but they generally won't do it because, again, they may not necessarily get that money back from the state.
Okay.
And so there's also county appointed attorneys where, for example, in Racine County, where I had my office, if you did not qualify for a public defender, you could ask the judge to appoint an attorney for you from the county appointment list.
Okay.
And the county appointed attorneys were private attorneys like myself mm-hmm. who were willing to take the pay rate that the county pays you, which was better actually than the public defender pays.
Okay.
And you could typically make a little bit more money than that public defender qualifying level.
But you'd be making less than if it was just a private, you know,
right.
person that retained you, correct?
And, oh, a lot less.
Okay.
Yeah. But you know, if I got arrested and I couldn't get a public defender, I might be able to get a county defender or a county appointed attorney, so to speak.
Okay.
And those were very rare. I mean, they did not give out a lot of county appointments because the county pays those attorneys versus the state paying the public defender.
Mm-hmm.
And the county only has a certain budget for county appointments. I would say that, I mean, I did a lot of public defender work when I first graduated from law school just to get experience and get in the courtroom more.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I was always in private practice and so the vast majority of my caseload was private clients.
Now, isn't there, even like, say you have your own, law office, is there a state mandate that you have to take X amount of like free cases per year, like pro se or whatever?
No,
it is.
Wisconsin does not require that. There
okay.
are some states that require X number of pro bono hours.
Yeah, pro bono.
A year.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah, but Wisconsin does not require that. So it's not mandatory.
Okay.
But like I said, I would occasionally take what's called a public defender appointed case, mm-hmm. where the public defender's office would call me and say, "Look, we have this case that we don't have anybody qualified to handle it. Can you take it?"
Okay.
Or everybody in our office who is qualified to handle it is so busy that they can't take it. Can you take it?
Okay.
And then in that case, the state would pay me, again, not what I would make representing someone privately, but I would get paid through the state that way.
Okay. Now, let me ask you this. For people who have never been arrested or have any kind of contact with the criminal justice system, you're this public defender. Well, not public defender, excuse me. You're the defense attorney. You're retained. You know, guy gets arrested and his wife calls you and say, "Hey, Jennifer, Fred was arrested. Can you please help him out?" Okay. What's the speak like? What are you saying to this person? When you first meet them, you know, what's that like? What kind of stuff is being discussed? What does it look like?
It definitely varies by case.
Okay.
but it, you know, if I get a phone call and says, you know, so-and-so was just arrested, can you go down to the jail and see them? Mm-hmm. You know, I say, yeah, I'll go. And I would go into the jail and we, you know, there's private meeting rooms for attorneys. And I usually just said, you know, hey, you know, I got a call from your sister or your wife or whatever. Right. She said you were arrested. You know, tell me, you know, what were you arrested for? What did they tell you were arrested for? Give me the rundown of what happened leading up to this incident. And it's a very, I don't want to say informal, but it's a lot different than the discussion I have once I've been paid and become a retained attorney.
Okay.
At that point, if his wife hasn't paid me and I'm not his retained, I'm not his retained attorney at this point. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to gauge kind of initially whether I think that there's any basis to kind of challenge those initial charges.
Okay.
And I'm not thinking down the road to trial at this point. I'm just thinking like, you know, he tells me I got pulled over. They told me it was for, you know, a taillight being out, but my taillights are all fine.
Okay.
Well, I mean, that's obviously something that I'm going to challenge at the initial appearance right off the bat.
Sure.
Or at least make an effort to, and call the DA. A lot of times it's, you know, then I would call, you know, I'd get out of the jail, I'd call the wife back and I'd say, look, I talked to your husband. This is what I think we have. This is what I think we don't have. I don't have the discovery. I don't have the police report.
Right.
I don't have, all I have is what that person tells me.
Okay.
And I will tell you that what people tell you, what clients tell you during an initial sit down conversation is almost never what they tell you later.
Okay.
Just because, and I don't mean that they're lying. I just mean that you get more information.
Well, some of them are lying, I'm sure.
The more removed they are from the situation, when they're all amped up and they just got arrested,
sure,
they're not thinking clearly enough to say that, oh my God, I didn't even think about this, but the officer said X, Y, Z to me. Mm-hmm. I've gotten a phone call a week later from somebody saying, I totally forgot that this actually happened.
Okay.
And that might change the case completely.
Right.
So when you're an attorney, it's important to get that initial story when you first meet with them, take good notes, make sure you understand what's happening and what they kind of, that kind of initial contact is. But it's a lot different once you have the police reports and you see what the state is alleging. It's a lot different once you give them time to kind of come down off of that initial adrenaline that's always there when they get arrested.
Okay.
And, you know, meet with them a day later or 2 days later and see where you're at. And a lot of times I would contact the DA immediately.
Okay.
And say, hey, I just got retained on so-and-so's case. Can you tell me what's up?
Mm-hmm.
And somebody like Sharon Rick, who I had so many cases with, I can't even count. You know, you have a rapport with the DA.
Right.
You have a long-standing relationship with the DA. And the DA might say to you, look, your guy's screwed. Like, this was a really bad situation. You know, he hit an officer, or he did this, or he did that. And then I know kind of right from the get-go that this is going to be a really hard case to resolve in a good fashion.
Right.
You know, you can kind of get a vibe from talking with a DA and having a friendly conversation.
Okay.
I never believed in going in unfriendly. I think that you always got a lot more done and got better deals for your clients if you were just a real human being with the DA and said, like, look, this is a guy with no criminal history. He's got kids. He's got a great job.
This is,
you know,
and that's a common trope that you see in TVs and movies. You know, the DA and the defense attorney are at each other's throats. It's like, you know, oh, I hate that person. You know, and then when you're immersed in it, you know, you could, well, in Milwaukee, we had just a ton of DAs. It was like a revolving door because as I was, when I interviewed Sharon, you know, we were talking about, it's like they made little to no money. It's kind of a launch pad for a career. You know, you get your experience there. And then I've seen many DAs go over to the defense side.
Yep.
You know, that's not uncommon. That's for sure. But again, they, you know, you have that trope where it's, you know, the big battle between the two. And most of the time, like you said, they don't even go to trial. And it's just, you know, what agreement can we make that we both can live with? And that the judge will say it's okay.
And And even when we would go to, even when you go to trial, yes, it's an adversarial system. And mm-hmm. yes, you are literally arguing against everything that person is arguing. And so there are high tensions there. And there are definitely some DAs and some defense attorneys who hate each other, who will not, who hate being in the same room with each other, who just despise each other, who don't get along for whatever personality wise. There are people that I didn't get along with. Like that's sure. That's just the nature of the business. But in general, you know, we kind of, especially in Racine where my office was, yes, I did practice in Milwaukee and some other surrounding counties, but I would say 70% of my caseload was in Racine.
Okay.
It's a very small legal community. There, you know, everyone. Right. And they're your friends. They're the people that you go to lunch with. They're the people that you grab a drink with after work.
Right.
You know, I had DAs over to my house for, you know, game night and parties and things like that. And, I mean, I went to law school with half the DAs in Milwaukee County. Sure. Those are people that like I've known for years.
Right.
And so I'm not going to stop being friends with them just because they're on the other side of the, you know, of the aisle. And I think that's where fiction writers sometimes get that wrong is yes, for the tension, you want there to be some headbutting, but it doesn't have to start out that way. I mean, have there be a reason for the headbutting, you know, have it be that, you know, you won a trial that destroyed their career or destroyed their credibility. And now he hates you because of it. Not just, simply because you're a defense attorney and a DA, you hate each other. Because that's just not realistic. Well, I mean, I don't think that that's the way that it is in most places.
The best attorneys I've ever seen working, even like in high profile cases or not even high profile cases, they're the least adversarial. You know, like I was talking about cops or detectives that are really good at interrogating people. They're not screaming at the top of their lungs. They're not throwing shit around the room. Maybe when they do raise their voice, it's kind of like a oh shit moment because, you know, you had this person lulled into this sense of security for a while, and then, you know, you're making a point. So I could see that too. But what people don't understand is there's discovery in a case, and the defense and the DA both have copies of all the police reports, you know, body camera footage. There isn't the big shock. I mean, there could be a shock as far as like what you're saying, what a witness might say, you know, when they're up on the stand. But, you know, what movie? I'm just trying to think, you know, a good example of, you know, somebody comes running in with, you know, that one piece of
evidence.
Yes.
Right.
You know,
no.
That doesn't happen.
That's so unrealistic. Well, and I mean, it's not just that it doesn't happen, but even if it happened, it doesn't mean that it would necessarily be admissible or that the jury would ever see the piece of evidence or hear about the piece of evidence because it has to be authenticated and the judge has to make a ruling of whether it's admissible or not.
Right.
And if you don't have, I mean, if somebody comes running in waving a video and says, hey, this is the exculpatory video.
Right.
Well, okay, where did the video come from? How do we know it wasn't doctored? Why, you know, like there are different things that would need to be proven to the court before it could ever be brought into.
Oh, right, because there's a chain of custody with any evidence, and you have to follow the breadcrumbs.
Well, and if it was to be determined that the state was withholding evidence and hiding evidence in any way that they knew existed, well, that's an automatic grounds for any number of things from a mistrial to, you know, the DA could potentially lose their law license for an ethics violation for withholding that type of information.
But
it's a violation.
It's so, high tension. It's, you know, it's dramatic, you know, it's so you see that in movies or in books or whatever. So I'm going to ask you this question. I was laughing when I wrote it. So how's it being married to another attorney? You're both really good at arguing. So somebody's, you know, every married couple, no matter how in love you are, no matter whatever, you're going to get into arguments. So what does that look like at your house, at the Severino house?
It's definitely, I think a little bit more tense. The arguments are a little bit... because neither one of us are like the type to back down either.
Okay. And, that could be problematic.
Yeah, I mean, and we're both litigators. It would be different if he was like a contract lawyer, but right. he's a civil litigator, and he did a little bit of criminal defense when he when he first graduated law school years ago. Mm-hmm. But you know, but at the same time, we don't really we very rarely argue where it's like we're actually mad arguing. Okay. We have a lot of like little bickery things where we're not, you know, it's not like a major, like actually right now, like we're arguing about a table that we bought. He thinks that if the color of the legs is too light for like the rest of the color of the house. And I think it looks great. And like, and he keeps saying that table's so awful. And I'm like, no, it's not. And like, I mean, it's, you know, but neither one of us really likes to give in. And so there are definitely times where I'll be like, you're out of line, counselor. And he'll be like, no, you're out of line.
You need a judge for that. You know, that's what you need.
Well, that's why we have a 4.5-year-old. She's our judge now. You know, she's the neutral party, but she's a daddy's girl. So it doesn't really help me any. She rules for dad all the time.
That's funny. I love it.
We joke about how we're like two litigators butting heads all the time, but like we're not a couple that argues a lot. We just kind of like, I think half the time we enjoy kind of just the argument just to have it. Like, you know, we'll be like, oh, we're not really that upset about it. He's not really that upset about the table color. He's just like, oh, you know, I want something to kind of complain about. And so I'm going to start a fight about it. You know, like.
That's funny. All right. We talked about, you know, the one dude that said he was going to do something bad to you, you know, and when you were in court or whatever. Has there been any other situations where you're like, I don't feel safe right now? You know, you're with these violent criminals and maybe in a small little room, or even like going to their house, or they're coming to your office, that kind of thing. Any scary stories you could tell us about where things got kind of shitty?
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple things. I mean, there have been times where I had to go to a client's house in North Milwaukee and, you know, I'm up on, you know, 25th and Humboldt or something. And I, you know, I'm in one of these areas and I'm, you know, the 5'3" blonde white girl, you know, driving my MDX through the ghetto.
I was gonna say a nice car. You'd be like, look at her.
I mean, it's not like I had like a fancy car, but I mean, I was definitely driving like, you know, a nicer car than a lot of what the cars up there are. Mm-hmm. And there were definitely times that I was not super comfortable, but it wasn't because I was necessarily afraid that like anyone would do anything to me. It was more that like, I have a lot of people that would walk up to me. Like if I got out of my car to go up to my client's house, I would have people, the whole neighborhood's up there. And you know, this, how the North Side is. Everybody knows everything that's going on in everybody else's house. And you know, if they see a car that they don't know drive down the street, everybody's at their window looking to see what's going on. And I would get out of my car and I'd have 10 people rush me and be like, hey, are you so-and-so's lawyer? I got this thing, or I got this thing, or I got this thing. And it was wasn't really that I was like super afraid for my safety. It was more that like, I don't like being put in a situation where I'm not in control of it. Okay. And being in a situation like that, where you're walking out in a neighborhood that you're not familiar with, and people you don't know are walking up to you and get right up on you. It's just a little bit like, I get a little bit like, okay, let's back up a little bit. I need to go talk to my client. He can give you my information if you want to call me later. You know, it's more about controlling the environment.
Okay.
The only other time where I felt like I am going to probably be killed was when I second chaired a homicide case and we won and the guy was acquitted.
Okay.
And the family of the victim started screaming in court, started threatening us, said, we're going to wait for you in the parking lot, all sorts of stuff. And this was in Milwaukee. This was in Milwaukee County. This was a Milwaukee County case. It was tried in front of Judge Dallet before she got on the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And she was one of my law school. Actually, she was my trial advocacy law school professor. So it was really fun to try a case in front of her.
I bet.
And she had the deputies escort me to my car. like literally armed deputies walk me to my car and make sure I got out of the parking structure because the family was violent, like to the point where they were arresting family members in the hallway because they were, you know, throwing things and causing a big disturbance. Sure. So that was the only other time I actually was concerned for my own safety.
All right. All right. Let's switch gears here. You help writers, you're a writer yourself, and you also help writers get their legal facts straight. And did you start the legal fiction Facebook group?
Yes.
Okay. Do you want to explain exactly what that is and how it helps?
Yeah. So it started with reading a lot of books that just got it wrong, like just bad courtroom scenes or bad portrayals of attorneys, bad research in terms of how things actually happen. Mm-hmm. And I read so many bad ones that I finally was like, we need a place where authors can come and ask questions so that they can try to make their books as accurate as possible. And so I started the legal fiction group on Facebook. And the entire purpose of the group is to allow fiction writers to come in and say, look, this is my scenario. Is this accurate? What do I need to change? How can I make this work? Things along those lines. And it's been super successful. People are getting all sorts of information that they need. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that legal fiction group, I also do legal fiction consulting services mm-hmm. where I will take an outline from someone or I will take a draft of a book from someone and I will read it and I will say, you know, these are the things that I suggest you change because they're not accurate or because it just doesn't go this way or whatever. And I make suggestions or tell them like, look, this is the law on this. This is what you would need to do to fix this plot to make it accurate. Now, fiction is fiction. Some people don't care. And they just say, you know what? That's too much rewriting work. I'm going to leave it like this. Sure. I know it's not accurate and that's fine. And if that's what they want to decide, that's great. But for people who want their books to be super accurate and they want somebody who knows the system to look at it, that's what I do. That's what I'm here for. So I offer that service to people and it's been really, really successful. I've had a lot of people who have been like, wow, you know, if I hadn't had you, I would have written 150,000 word book. And had to scrap 75,000 of it because the entire plot was wrong, you know.
Backing up to the legal fiction group, what should people do when they're when they want to become a member? What should they do?
So we're laughing about this because I told Patrick that I deny anyone who tries to come into the legal fiction group without answering the questions. So please, 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 we would love to have you, but answer the questions.
And they're not tough
questions.
One of
the reasons.
Even I get those right.
It says, are you an author? Do you understand that that these are for fictional purposes only? Do you understand that we are not creating an attorney-client relationship? I have to ask these things because of the questions that are answered in this group. All right. This is a CYA. Yep. I need to cover my ass. I need to cover the asses of the other attorneys in the group who help answer questions so that if anybody comes to us 3 years later and says, well, attorney Severino told me in the legal fiction group that I could do this in real life because, you know, of the law. Well, I can go back and I can say, if they were in the legal fiction group, they answered those questions and they understood that I was not giving them legal advice, that I was not creating an attorney-client relationship with them, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So please, if you want to join legal fiction, answer the questions to be admitted. Otherwise, we have to. I've told my other admins to deny requests. And that's just to cover our asses, guys. We have to do it.
Gotcha. I'm glad we have that covered. All right. What do you think are some of the biggest mistakes authors make or screenwriters, TVs, movies, books when it comes to legal stuff, you know, attorneys, all that kind of good stuff?
The one we already talked about, just mm-hmm. like the adversarial.
Yep. Besides what we were talking about. Yeah.
Right. I think one of them is timelines and sure. how slow the court system moves.
It certainly does.
You're not having a murder trial in 3 months after the person. It's just not going to happen. I mean, the only way that you're having a murder trial within 3 months of the person getting killed is if there's a speedy trial demand made by the defendant. And if it's like a super clear cut case where the state thinks they have all their ducks in a row.
A speedy trial could be a year later.
Right. A speedy trial could even be a year later.
Yeah, I'm just,
in Wisconsin, it depended on the county.
Sure.
But in Wisconsin on a homicide, I would say a year to 3 years would be reasonable for the amount of time before it goes to trial. And people go, wow, 3 years? How is that possible? Well, if you're looking at a case that has, you know, thousands of pages of discovery, dozens and dozens of witnesses, a lot of complicated legal issues where I'm filing a motion to suppress a statement, I'm filing a motion to exclude evidence, I'm filing a motion for this, I'm filing a motion for that. You have to have a hearing for those motions. Then the judge has to make a decision on it. Then based on that decision, you have to decide whether you're still going to go to trial or not. So things move at a very slow snail's pace in any type of case, whether it's drugs or homicide or whatever, but especially homicide cases move slowly.
Well, and the thing about it too is you'll have your defendant that will do everything they can to drag it on. Because the longer you wait, there's cops retire, detectives we retire, we die,
witnesses disappear.
Yeah, they don't want to be a witness anymore. You know, you had your star eyewitness. 3 years later, they've been intimidated by somebody, like say it's a gang thing or something like that, and it's like, oh hell no. Or maybe they've turned into a criminal themselves, or they were a criminal, now they're a bigger criminal, and it's like,
and they don't want to be under the scrutiny of testifying anymore. Correct. Or maybe they moved out of the state. I mean, I've had several cases where I represented people, and it was, well, our victim moved to Arkansas and we offered to pay to fly them here and put them in a hotel to come testify, and they said no.
Right. And some people couldn't afford to do that. If you have a job, you know, and it's oh great, I'm going to be stuck in this 2 week trial or whatever, and I'm not getting paid. So this sucks, you know, and maybe I don't care if justice is served. I got to pay my rent. So, you know,
So I think timelines are a big issue.
Okay.
I also think one of the biggest issues and why finding a legal consultant like what I do is super important is what is actually said on the record while people are in a courtroom. All right. You know, I've seen these trial scenes where they have attorneys asking leading questions while they're giving a direct exam. Okay. You're not allowed to use leading questions during a direct examination. You're only allowed to use leading questions during a cross examination.
Okay.
So things like that, it's things where, you know, the opposing counsel would be objecting left and right, and the judge would be admonishing you to change your question.
Okay.
So, you know, it's things like that that you could very easily fix and have them be done properly if you had somebody who knew what to look for.
So
it's fiction. If you don't care, leave it. But if you do care, there are people who can help you.
So let me ask you this. Oftentimes you see some critical part of a trial and you have the defense attorney and the prosecutor, you know, kind of going at it a little bit. And then the judge is like, approach the bench. You know, and he's got his hand over the microphone. Does that ever happen?
So those are called sidebars.
Yes.
And yes, those happen all the time during trials. Mm-hmm. And the reason that they do that is because there's a lot of things the jury's not supposed to hear.
Right.
And I've had a couple of trials where the judge would call us up and say, like, look, counsel, I can tell where this questioning is heading. Make sure you don't cross the line from X to Y, because if you do, I'm going to interrupt you and you're going to look very bad in front of you're going to look bad in front of the jury, or that could cause a mistrial, you know, especially if there's been evidence that's been excluded or there's hearsay evidence that's been excluded because they don't have the original speaker there to testify. Mm-hmm. Well, if the judge thinks that you're trying to figure out a back door to get these things in that have been excluded, well, that would be a major problem for the trial. So a lot of times a judge will pull either counsel, you know, mm-hmm. doesn't matter who's doing the questioning,
right.
pull you both to the front and say, let's be careful about this. Or he might say, should we send the jury back so we can have a ruling on this before we even get to that question?
Okay.
And so a lot of times it's something like that. Sometimes it's as simple as, how many more witnesses do you have before we can take a lunch break?
Sure.
I mean, it can be something totally innocuous, or it could be something where the judge is concerned about something that's happening during the trial and he wants to make sure that it's, you know, clear. And oftentimes after the sidebar, then something gets put on the record.
Okay.
If a decision's been made, you know, if something has happened that needs to be, a record needs to be made of it for purposes of the trial transcript, mm-hmm. then the judge will say, you know, I just had a sidebar with counsel. We decided, you know, XYZ was discussed. But a lot of times it's something that doesn't have to go on the record. Okay. And so that's why it's so important. I do a lot of appellate work too, where it's somebody who's already been convicted and I'm reviewing the case based off transcripts and that's it. That's why it's really important to get the original trial counsel's handwritten notes from during the trial.
Okay.
Because if I have a sidebar with the judge, the first thing I do when I sit down is I say, sidebar at whatever time.
Okay.
This is exactly what was said.
So you document what was said.
I document what was said okay. because if they're doing an appeal 10 years from now, I might not remember what was said during that
sure.
sidebar, you know?
Right, right.
So I think that, you know, there's like little tricks that you can do in mm-hmm. fiction to bring up tension that don't require you to be inaccurate is okay. kind of one of the things that I tell a lot of my authors is you can have a sidebar and a judge is warning somebody about something and you can do these little things that kind of make break up a scene and help with the flow a little bit. And you can condense timelines in a way that's believable instead okay. of having the jury trial happen a month later.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Jennifer is also a writer. So whenever I have a writer on the show, I kind of have a little lightning round where I'm going to ask you some questions. First off, what genres do you write in?
I write romance and okay. I write pretty much every subgenre of romance. I do okay. contemporary romance, romantic suspense, romantic comedy, dark romance. I kind of paranormal romance. I okay. dabble in everything.
So you published about 35 novels?
Something like that. 35 okay. novels and novellas. I do have quite a few novellas too, but okay. yeah, somewhere in that range.
Are you indie or are you hybrid or what are you?
I am indie published, and then okay. I do have some foreign publishers that have picked up and translated my books. So okay. I'm traditionally published in other countries, but my English stuff is indie published.
Gotcha. So where do you come up with your ideas for stories and characters? Where do they come from?
Some of them do come from real life. There are, you know, one of my series involves the mafia. Ah. And there are times that I've taken, you know, some of my interactions with people or cases that I know about. Maybe mm-hmm. they're not even my cases, but
sure.
cases I've seen other attorneys on.
Okay.
And facts of those cases. And I'll be like, wow, like, this guy is, you know, scary. I'm going to put him in this book, you
sure.
know? And I mean, they're not the real people. They're based loosely off things that I heard. Mm-hmm. There's no, you know, I never violate any sort of attorney client confidentiality or put anything like that in there. But,
right.
you know, I used to represent a particular motorcycle club in Milwaukee and members of this particular motorcycle club had a reputation and they were the nicest clients I ever had. They were great to me. They were fab. They were great. They were wonderful people to me. Not so wonderful to some other people though.
No,
and
no.
So, you know, motorcycle romance is super popular right now. Mm. And there are times that I'm reading these or I'm working on one of my books and I might write an MC in as the bad guys and loosely base them off this particular
gotcha.
Motorcycle club. So yeah, my ideas, a lot of them come from real life. A lot of them come from like, I'm one of those people who has a dream and I wake up in the morning and I'm like,
God,
that would be something.
Do you have a pad of paper on your bedstand?
I do. And I'll be like, oh God, that would be such a good scene for a book. And I might have a one scene, one dream, and it might spawn a book that's 150,000 words long. You know, and I kind of have one of those brains that's always full of ideas.
Okay.
And that's not the problem. Ideas are never the problem. It's finding time to get them all written.
Well, that's my next question. You know, you're a busy person. You know, you're a mom. You do a bunch of other stuff, and you have to balance all that. So what does your day look like? Like, what time do you wake? Do you wake up before, you know, anybody else gets up and get your writing done? Or are you an evening writer, or are you a morning writer, or whenever you can fit it in?
I probably should get up early and get a couple of hours of work in, but I don't, because I'm not a morning person at all.
Okay.
My husband is up at 5 a.m. and he usually has 2 hours of work in before I even wake up around 7.
Wow.
my daughter typically sleeps till about 6:37, and she's 4 and a half. So, you know, as soon as she's up, there's no more sleeping. She's
right.
Pretty loud. And so that's about the time I usually get up. And if it's a day that she's doesn't have something going on outside of the house, like school or something, then, and she's here with me all day, then I probably get maybe 2 or 3 hours a day to work.
Okay.
Because I can, you know, she can entertain herself and play by herself for an hour in like kind of hour spurts here and there. But on days when she's in school, it's great, you know, cause I get a whole day to just sit and work.
Okay.
And so what I try to do is, you know, balance, finding time for those things. I also do work at night a lot, but I'm not a stay up till 3 a.m. working person. I try to be in bed by midnight. I try, you know, at the latest, because I know I'm getting woken up at 6:45.
Oh, sure.
I've kind of adjusted since becoming a mom to get it in where I can.
Okay.
One thing I also do is I dictate.
I was just going to say, do you dictate or do you manually type?
Well, I prefer to manually type, and and that would, I would love to do that all the time, but it's just unrealistic for me to do that.
You get a lot more words done if you dictate, that's for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, I'll walk the dog and, you know, if I walk the dog 3 laps around our neighborhood, I know I can usually dictate about 2.5 to 3 chapters.
Okay.
So I try to fit it in wherever I can.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. So when you are doing this, do you use software like Scrivener or just Word, or what do you use?
I dictate into a voice recorder. Mm-hmm. And then I use Dragon Professional to transcribe it.
Okay.
You can just plug the voice recorder into your computer.
Straight into Word then, or?
Yeah. And well, yeah. Dragon types it up straight into Word.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. All right.
I'm one of those people who never really got the hang of Scrivener. I've had it for years.
Same here. Maybe it just didn't compute
with
me.
Not my brain. Yeah. Like my brain just doesn't.
Like right now I've got sticky notes all around my computer. That's how I get ready for a podcast. And that's the way my brain works. I know Scrivener makes a ton of sense and is super awesome, but I have it and I've used it, but I always revert back to, I guess, what I know better. I don't know.
Me too.
All right. Are you a pantser or a plotter?
Oh, I'm a big plotter.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I plot a lot, and I actually do plot for other authors too. I help them with their plots because my brain thinks that way.
Okay.
And a lot of authors, they can't see the linear fashion of a story, and they can't see the plot arcs and the character arcs.
Sure.
But I tend to think in arcs. So I help a lot of people do their plotting. I love doing plotting. I think it's so much fun.
Okay. Okay. Knowing what you know now, when you first started, what would you have done differently?
Oh gosh, a lot. So I started publishing 5 years ago.
Okay.
And I would have been, the whole publishing world has changed so much even in the last 2 years.
Sure.
That like But I would have been more careful about my branding. I would have not taken advice from certain people who I thought knew what they were talking about, who were
like what kind of advice?
Know what they were talking about. Well, I mean, I had a lot of people who were like, you know, write this, do this, you know, this is what you should be doing, this is what you should be doing. And then I look back at it and I'm like, if I had gone with my gut, I would be in a much better position.
Do you remember exactly what they were saying or what your gut was telling you?
Well, I mean, it's not stuff that's necessarily, I don't know, it's as relevant today, but you know, there's like a big divide of people that say publish everything under one pen name or have five pen names for five different genres, right?
Yeah.
So, and that's like a very, people are either hot or cold on that topic. And, I got the advice to create the second pen name for one of my paranormal series. Mm-hmm. And then I was trying to juggle two pen names. So I was trying to advertise two pen names. I was trying to advertise two series. I was trying to run multiple pages and multiple groups and all those things. And I said, you know, there is so much crossover between readers who read contemporary romance and who read paranormal romance that it's absolutely stupid for me to be writing under two pen names.
Well, because there are people that are successful that are even writing fiction and nonfiction, you know, something that far apart that they have the same name, but they have super fans that pretty much, you know, that's like, oh, Jennifer wrote this. I'm buying it because I like all of her stuff, you know. But I see both sides of the argument. I do
too, because I mean, there are definitely valid points for why you want different pen names, you know, because the also bots on Amazon will not necessarily be the right types of books if people, your also bots are all your books from a different genre.
I don't even know if that's that big of a deal anymore. Like also bots, it used to be, but
well, they come and go. The problem is Amazon takes them and then gives them away.
Yes. Back. Hey, where did that go? And you're looking at your page. You're like, hey, didn't I have also bots?
They are still very relevant though. I mean, I can't deny that they are still very relevant. It's not what it was 5 years ago, but you know, that was just one of the pieces of advice that like, yeah, I took that advice. I thought it made sense at the time. And then I wasted probably 2 years trying to balance two pen names and finally gave up. It was just like, I can't do it anymore. That's not where my time needs to be spent.
Sure.
And.
Okay. That makes sense. So what works best for you for selling books? Is it ads? Is it your brand? And if it is ads, what kind of ads are you running? How much do you put into it? Are you wide? Are you just with Amazon? And what's your rationale behind it?
So I am wide, and I've pretty much always been wide because the two or three times that I attempted KU, I hemorrhaged money. I lost so much money being in KU.
Okay.
Versus what I was making wide. And I also don't like the idea of a monopoly, which is essentially what Amazon is creating, and they're trying to push out these other retailers.
Sure.
I don't like how Amazon messes with KU authors. I mean, from a legal perspective, I've had friends who have had their page reads stripped and been told you violated X policy, or, you know, we saw something shady. Well, these are not authors who are making $10,000 a month. Right. These are authors who are making $300 a month. Mm-hmm. Why, you know, if they were using a click farm or something shady for their KU reads, they have a lot more than $300 a month. Sure. And these are people that I personally know and trust. And I know that they're not doing this, but there's no way to challenge that. Okay. I mean, you ask Amazon for the proof and they don't provide it. And their terms of service say that you won't file a lawsuit. You'll take it to mediation, arbitration. And I mean, I think for me personally, I don't want all my eggs in one basket. Okay. If that basket is Amazon. I mean, KU works great for a lot of people, and a lot of authors make a shitload of money on KU, and that's great for them. But remember that Amazon can take it away at any time.
Sure. They can change the terms whenever they want to. I understand that. Yeah. You know, it's a double-edged sword. There's no doubt about it. What works for you for selling books?
I have a very active reader group with about 2,500 people in it. I have a 15,000 person newsletter list. Okay. I have, Facebook ads.
For somebody new that's listening to this or newer or trying to get traction, how did you build such a extensive mailing list? How did you get so many people into it?
that my list is totally organic. I have not done any newsletter builders. I'm one of those people who kind of believes that that newsletter builders only really get you freebie seekers.
So obviously you have something in your front matter or back matter saying, hey, you know, right. Do you offer something like a free novella or something for?
I do have a free novella that they can get for signing up for my newsletter.
Okay.
But I didn't even start doing that till a year ago. And my list was already 14,000 or 12,000 before I started doing that. And that was all organic. That's all people signing up at the back of my book.
Yeah.
And people going to my website you know, people in the reader group signing up for it. And I think that both ways can work for people. I know people who have, you know, lists that are 50,000 people that they've gotten all from Book Funnel or Story Origin signups, and they do really well for them. And that's great. But I also have a lot of friends who, you know, get 10,000 people sign up through one of those things and then, you know, 5,000 unsubscribe the next day because they just wanted the freebie book and then they wanted to get off your newsletter list.
Right.
So, or they, you know, they get more people marking them as spam. They get more problems with their newsletter service because people are marking them as spam or they have so many unsubscribers.
Let me ask you this. How often do you send out a newsletter to your peeps?
I send out at least once a week, sometimes twice a week.
Really? So what are you talking about? That's a lot.
But I release a lot. I release at least once a month, sometimes twice a month.
See, then that makes total sense then.
I am all, but even when I wasn't releasing that much, even when I was releasing once every 3 months, I was still sending out at least twice a month.
So what were you saying to them? If you weren't releasing that much, what would you say? Were you including things about your personal life?
Yeah, I mean, I don't do a ton of stuff about my personal life because you know, because of legal issues, I don't want to have, you know, my pen name tied to my legal name. I practiced law under, but I'll say like, oh my God, you know, we had snow in Las Vegas for the first time in 5 years and my daughter played on it today. And isn't that crazy? Oh, by the way, did you know that I have a fun holiday romance that has snow in it? And then I might plug my book.
Sure.
So I try to not make it salesy, you know, I don't want to be like, buy my book. But I want it to be a little bit more personal. I also share snippets of books that I'm working on.
Okay.
They're always really short, just a paragraph or two from the book and say, ooh, can you guys wait? This sounds great. You know, and I always, you know, include pre-order links. I always include the newest release. And then I also will include books from friends who have new releases or sale.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
All right, because I've heard all different kinds of theories on that. Ads, which ones do you run? Facebook, Amazon?
Facebook.
Okay, that works good for you.
I love Brian Cohen, and I've done his challenge 4 or 5 times, and I still can't figure out AMS ads. So, I mean, I know how to do them, but I don't get the results from them.
Okay.
I think that they're really, really good for KU books. I don't think they're as good. Personally, I don't think they're as good for books that are wide and when you're charging $4.99 for a book. I think that a lot of the readers that are on Amazon that are seeing those ads have KU.
Sure.
So even if they like your ad and they click on it, as soon as they see it's not a KU book, they're gone, you know?
Okay.
So Facebook ads have had the best ROI for me, hands down. And I know a lot of people say, oh, I wasted so much money on Facebook ads. It just eats your budget. Mm-hmm. You know, I never see any return. If that's happening to you, you need to take a look at a few things.
Okay.
Is your cover on genre? Is your blurb good? What's your landing page look like on Amazon? And then also, are you targeting the right type of audiences on Facebook?
Sure.
Because having successful ads is about all four of those things.
Okay.
And you can kind of go through and change each one to make them on point to narrow down what the issue is.
Okay.
And fix it.
Right. You know, everybody's saying now, like you said, things change very quickly in this business. And we're definitely in a pay-to-play kind of atmosphere. Do you concur with that? Do you believe it?
I do. And I think, I mean, I do. I recently made a couple of my first in series permanently free, which I always said I would never do. but I don't, they're only for my series that are novellas. My okay. novels, I still have the first book in those series at full price.
Okay.
But with my novella series, I thought, you know, novellas, I only charge $2.99 for them anyway. Mm-hmm. So if I'm giving away book one, I'm only losing a dollar, whatever. Yeah, it's not a big deal.
And it gets you into the ecosystem of Jennifer.
Yeah, right. And then then they'll read through and they'll buy the other sure. five, six, whatever novellas in the series at $2.99. And it's a very easy way to get people into your series. Okay. But you do have to pay then to do newsletters like Free Booksy, Fussy Librarian, sure, sure. things like that that get your freebie put in front of people. Mm. I do get a ton of organic downloads without doing those newsletters, okay. but I do those newsletters on a rotating basis throughout the year so that there's a fresh batch of a bunch of people downloading okay. them.
All right. Very good. So you got a plan and you're using it, damn it. All right. I think, you know what? This is a good place to end our conversation. Where can people find you, Jennifer?
So my website is twitchingpen.com. Twitching Pen Editing is my company. I currently do content editing, line and copy editing, proofreading, and then the legal consulting services that I mentioned. And that is usually the best place to find me, or in the legal fiction group. If you just search legal fiction on Facebook, it'll pop up right away. It's, again, please answer the questions if you want to come into it. Or you can email me at jennifer@twitchingpen.com. And those are the best places to get in touch with me.
Okay, that sounds great. Well, thank you very much for being my guest today.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. I hope you enjoyed episode 10 of the Cops and Writers podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to the show. Thank you, Attorney Severino, for being on the show today. I think the information in today's episode will help a lot of writers. Thanks to all of you who support my work, either through buying my books in the Cops and Writers series available on Amazon, being a patron at patreon.com/copsandwriters. Yes, you could be a patron of the show for less than a cup of coffee. Participating in my Cops and Writers Facebook group, hiring me as a consultant for your work, or visiting me at my website, copsandwriters.com. Thank you so much. Before I go, could you do me a favor? Could you please hit the subscribe button and leave a review for the podcast? It would be so helpful, and it makes sure you don't miss an episode of the podcast. That's it for now. Thanks again, and let's be careful out there.